Welcome to Earth Matters on Gila Members Community Radio, KURU at 89.1 FM, the show that brings you in-depth coverage of local, regional, and national environmental issues. For podcasts of this show and any others, you can go to the Earth Matters page on Gila Members Community Radio website. I'm Donna Stevens, your host for today's program, and I'm the executive director of the Upper Gila Watershed Alliance. We're a local nonprofit working to protect the Gila watershed through advocacy, education, and restoration. Joining me in the studio is my guest for the first part of the show, Gabe Vasquez. Gabe is the Southern New Mexico Outreach Coordinator for the New Mexico Wildlife Federation. In the second half of the show, we'll be joined by Jason Amaro of the Backcountry Hunters and Anglers, and we'll be talking in today's show about public lands, the Trump administration's review of 26 national monuments, the importance of citizen involvement, and more. Welcome, Gabe.
Thank you, Donna.
Well, I wanted to start today's show by talking about the sportsman's group you work with, Gabe, the New Mexico Wildlife Federation. So I don't hunt or fish. And so years ago, I was pretty surprised to find that I have a lot in common with the goals of your organization. Can you please tell us a few of the most important issues that you work on?
Sure. And thanks, Donna, for having me on today. It's a pleasure to be here with you and to be with the listeners of Silver City and the surrounding area. I'll start by saying that although I grew up fishing in New Mexico, I never really considered myself a sportsman until recent years, at least not in the way that most people think about it today. I think that's because for many New Mexicans, fishing and hunting is a way of life. It's just like hiking or kayaking or climbing for others. The common thread here is that the outdoors for New Mexicans plays a significant part of our lives. So when we think about that, I think we can start looking at many different shared interests, especially when it comes to protecting this place that we call home. It's important to all of us. And so at the New Mexico Wildlife Federation, we really pride ourselves in our conservation ethic as sportsmen and women and as outdoor educators, but also because the oldest conservation organization in the state. In fact, Silver City is special to me. It's special to us as an organization because the Wildlife Federation was started by Aldo Leopold. Right here in Grant County. So from that, there are several issues that we're currently working on throughout the state as part of our overall goals of landscape scale conservation, of preserving wildlife habitat, improving wildlife corridors and connectivity, and ensuring that New Mexicans have public access to public lands. So in the southern part of the state, which is where I work, I'm working the Gila and the Lincoln National Forest Plan revisions, as you're aware of. I'm finding some smarter, we're working to find smarter alternatives to the proposed Gila River diversion. We're trying to put a stop to this crazy idea of a border wall, and we're working on the permanent protection for several unique and beautiful landscapes here, including our own Organ Mountain Desert Peaks National Monument and Otero Mesa out near Alamogordo.
Wow, it sounds like you have your work cut out for you. That's a pretty tall order to work on all of those big issues.
It is, and it's a blessing and a curse at the same time because I get to travel the southern part of the state and experience some really beautiful natural places, fight to protect them and to conserve them. But you're right, it does, the days do get pretty long and start blending together after a couple of weeks.
Right. So your job, Gabe, is that of an outreach coordinator. What does that really mean?
Yeah, so that's a pretty loaded title. I think the original intent of the position was to have someone representing sportsmen and women in southern New Mexico and representing their interests when it comes to conservation and public lands issues. But I really just find myself talking to people from all walks of life about conservation of our rivers, our streams, our forests, mountains, and deserts, and prompting action in our community toward conservation goals. And it's really evolved quite a bit, I think, from what my job description was on paper to kind of what I'm doing now. I do have some public policy background, and so I find myself sometimes in the weeds working on local, regional, and some national policy related to the work that we do here, as well as the community outreach component. And then the other piece I'm really passionate about that I think adds some of the strength of what we do at the Federation is that I really enjoy working and connecting with youth, in particular with Hispanic and underserved youth, and connecting them to outdoor experiences. And so we started a program here that does that called the Nuestra Tierra Conservation Project, which has been keeping me pretty busy. In fact, we have a rafting trip in the Rio Grande coming up in a couple of weeks, which is exciting because, one, there's actually water in our river down south, and two, none of these kids have ever been rafting before. And so hopefully that lends itself in the future to creating some future conservation stewards here in New Mexico. So that's kind of a mix of some of the things that I do down here.
Wow, that sounds great. So these kids have never, they've never been rafting before. Have they been to the river? I mean, because we see kids around here who've never been to the Gila River, and they live right here in Silver City.
Yeah, I mean, I think I got a pretty good laugh out of them when I told them that we were going rafting in the river for the first time, because they didn't realize there was even water in the river, because it can be pretty spontaneous. But the majority of the time, it's dry, as you know, before the reservoirs let out water for the irrigation season. And so just the concept of even rafting on the river to the youth that we were working with in Las Cruces seemed kind of crazy to them. But once I told them, you know, that we were actually going to do this, And we start doing our safety training and all that stuff, it's real for them, and they're excited. And with the recreational experience, we'll also couple in some self-discovery kind of curriculum opportunities for them to really learn about conservation. We're going to teach them why the river is dry for so many months of the year, and what irrigation and what agriculture means, and what kind of impact it has on our water system, and also teach them about the native fish that exists in the river, the wildlife habitat that depends on riparian areas, such as the Rio Grande. And so we have fun, and we get to learn a little bit along the way, too.
That sounds really great. I'm glad you're doing that kind of work. And speaking of rivers, I understand that the Wildlife Federation opposes a diversion on the Gila River. And can you tell us why?
Yeah, it's you know, it's not only a terrible idea engineering wise. I think anybody with any common sense that knows the ecology of this river and the wildlife habitat that this river supports will tell you that it's not a good starting point when we're talking about meeting our water needs in the future. The proposed diversion, I think, significantly, under the different iterations that have taken fruit, have can all, you know, have a significant impact on wildlife habitat. That's important to sportsmen and women, as well as recreational uses of the river and those with interest in conserving the river for future generations. The Gila, like I said, it's a special place to for New Mexicans. It's a special place for us. In the shadow of the legacy of Aldo Leopold. And I'd argue that for the world, I mean, the Gila River is a largely, you know, unspoiled southwestern river that is unique to not just to us here in New Mexico, but to the world. And so changing the course of this river for the benefit of just a few interests in the name of some dollars and cents, which the majority of southwest New Mexicans I don't think would ever get to see the benefit of, makes no sense to us. And so beyond the damage to habitat and riparian areas, there's a huge cost burden that's associated with this project that we think ultimately is gonna fall on the back of struggling New Mexicans. And so, you know, families that are already in poverty that will likely be asked to pay for, you know, millions of dollars in taxes to pay for this project and potentially see no benefit. In fact, just the opposite, they'll be paying to fragment and limit, you know, their habitat and recreation opportunities with their own tax dollars. That's just not right. And we think there's it's a misguided effort on the part of the governor and the Interstate Stream Commission. And there's other ways to meet our future water needs, I think, as the town of Silver City has really been an example of with their water conservation program here.
Well, we agree with you 100% on that. We've done many shows here about the Gila River and its threat by a diversion, which we think is misguided and super expensive, as you pointed out. So I know that in April, you and some other people went on a camping and fishing trip with Bishop Oscar Cantu and other Catholic priests from Las Cruces. And where did you guys go, and what was the purpose of this trip?
That was a lot of fun. Thanks for bringing that up. That was tons of fun. And you can start from the beginning. It was a little scary for me. I was driving a 15-passenger van, and I was going from church to church here, county to county, and picking up priests. Huh. And I was never more nervous of driving a van in my life. I figured if anything happened, our spiritual capital, at least in the Catholic Church,
would be
in dire need of some new leadership if anything had happened there.
Yeah, it'd be like the Buddy Holly effect all going down at once.
That's exactly right. So actually, I had a good friend of mine, Beth Bardwell, who helped organize this trip from Audubon, New Mexico, and I kind of told Beth, I said, maybe the bishop should go in your car, just in case.
Right.
And actually, we did do that unintentionally, but it did relieve some pressure. But actually, the priests here in the Copper Vicariate and from the Las Cruces Catholic Diocese were a lot of fun. I really enjoyed spending some time with them. But this idea really came about from a visit from a water, I think he's a hydrologist or a water engineer named Jorge Figueroa. You may have featured him on the show, or he may have been here doing some interviews with media. But he works for Western Resource Advocates.
Okay.
And he's actually helping to develop some of those alternative water conservation plans, particularly out in Deming. And so he had this idea of, you know, if we really want our communities to be connected to this issue, we have to bring it to them. And so one of the ways we can do that is through some of our religious and faith leaders that we have here that can connect with their congregants and constituents. So I'm a Catholic myself. I grew up with a certain spiritual obligation I felt to nature that my dad really helped instill in me. And it was kind of this obligation to really care for our common home. And it started, for example, when we went camping, to make sure we picked up after ourselves, or when we went fishing, that we didn't exceed or violate bag limits on, you know, things like bass or catfish or walleye, and understanding why we had to do that. And so when we talked to the bishop about this opportunity to come here to camp and fish with us and enjoy some time in the Gila, we really wanted him to kind of look at the diversion from a moral perspective. And so during that process, we presented the bishop with some alternatives to the diversion and asked if he would consider taking a position on the diversion in the future. And he did, and we're very, you know, excited and thankful that he did that. So the trip itself was kind of, hey, you know, we've showed you a little bit of what the plans are, what some of the problems are currently with the proposed diversion. Let's go out there and actually see the land, see the landscape. And Martha Cooper at the Nature Conservancy, we are super grateful for her because she let us stay at her place in Cliff. We were in the Gila Cliff Valley at the Gila River Farm. And it was actually kind of surreal because the bishop actually gave mass on the morning after we went camping inside the Lichty Center, which is kind of a research facility. And I'm guessing for Martha, that'd probably be the only time that a bishop is going to deliver Catholic mass inside her research center out in
probably
the middle of the river.
Right, yeah.
But it was really, really cool. And we're super thankful that she hosted us. And we're very thankful also for the advocacy from Bishop Cantu.
Well, I'm going to ask you a little bit about that, a little bit more about what he said, Gabe, after we come back from the break. Please stay with us. Welcome back to Earth Matters here on KURU 89.1 FM. I'm Donna Stevens, your host for today's program, and my guest here in the studio is Gabe Vasquez of the New Mexico Wildlife Federation. Right before the break, we were talking about a trip that Gabe and some other conservationists took with Archbishop, I always want to call him Archbishop, Bishop Oscar Cantu and other Catholic priests from Las Cruces. And you guys went on the Gila, as you were saying before the break. And then what came out of that is that Bishop Cantu wrote an editorial which appeared in, what, the Las Cruces papers and Silver City?
I believe Silver City, and I think the Deming Headlight actually just published it last week.
A
little late for Earth Day, but we appreciate it nonetheless, and still as relevant now as it was then. And we're hoping it'll get some reach beyond the South here and up to Albuquerque and maybe Santa Fe, where some of the decision makers also are for this particular project.
That would be great. Can you tell us, just share a couple of the highlights of the guest editorial that he wrote?
Sure. Well, I was really happy to read what the bishop wrote, because it really reflected some of the things we experienced on our fishing trip and some of the things he spoke about to other priests and to us about why it was important to kind of care for God's creation. And so in his editorial, he touched on some themes from the Pope's 2015 publication called Laudato Si, in which Pope Francis calls attention to caring for our common home in a sort of a call to action. And it asked Catholic faith leaders and others to do what they can to ensure that we care for this place that we all share as a shared obligation that we're responsible for the next generation. And so his editorial, it also touched on the social justice aspect of the diversion, which is one of the things that we've been trying to highlight, particularly in Deming. And he spoke of the tax issue that we spoke about earlier, and spoke about the unfairness of those that are poor and suffering that would have to shoulder the burden of a project that would bring them no benefit. And he looked at it from just a strictly kind of a morality angle. And we really appreciate that, because when you take some of the politics out of it and you say it's this side against that side, fundamentally, I think what the bishop really talked about was that this is just an immoral thing to do, both to our river and to the people who would be forced to pay for it. And so I think the bishop understands that there's more reasonable ways to secure water for our residents here. And there's options that are much less expensive and destructive to our environment. And so I think, you know, he combined those messages and also emphasized that his message was not political as much as some would like to politicize it, but that it's coming from this common theme that the Pope has really called on faith leaders to act on, but also because we're responsible for God's creation. And you know, we should look at all the options on the table to make sure that we minimize our impact to God's creation before we move forward with projects like the Gila diversion.
Well, amen to that.
That's right.
Yeah.
Yes.
So switching gears just a little bit here, but staying with the morality of environmental issues, can you talk about the Trump administration's review, his recent announcement that he wants his administration to review 26 national monuments?
Oh, man. Oh, I think we would have to spend a couple of hours if we wanted to go through what some of the motivations I personally suspect are behind this. But yeah, for those not familiar, there's executive order in a string of executive orders. One of them has directed our Department of Interior to review national monuments over 100,000 acres going back to the Clinton era designation. So that was a move specifically made to include Grand Staircase Escalante in Utah, designated in 1996 under President Clinton, which has been, for Utah politicians that some would call members of the Anti-Parks Caucus, has been their kind of sticking point about these illegally made designations through the Antiquities Act, which is actually a tool that Teddy Roosevelt first used to create national monuments like the Grand Canyon in Arizona, and has been used bilaterally from different administrations, both Republican and Democrat, up until now. So it's not a political tool. It's just simply another tool in the toolkit of an administration to be able to protect and conserve some of our monuments. But I think this was really led by politicians from Utah, in particular Representative Bishop and Governor Herbert, who for years have been lobbying both in Congress and in the previous Republican administration to undo these national monuments. And though a lot of that, I speculate, comes from some self-interest from different industries that operate in Utah that would probably really like access to some of these really pristine natural places that actually, if you were to look at the economic impact, have similar, if not greater, benefit to local communities from the tourism dollars that they bring in, as opposed to the extractive energy development. And so that kind of spurred the review of these 26 national monuments. And right now there's a comment period that I would encourage listeners to participate in. There's a 60-day comment period where the Department of Interior is asking for people's opinions on the national monuments in their communities. And so certainly, our two here are Organ Mountains Desert Peaks National Monument and Rio Grande del Norte National Monument. Both are open for public comment. And we can't say what this review is going to entail, but we can speculate from what we've heard from some of our partners on the field in terms of what the Bureau of Land Management and the Department of Interior, the National Park Service, all these different land management agencies that have to undergo these reviews, you know, what that is actually going to entail, we're not sure yet.
How can people participate in that comment period if they'd like to?
Sure. So there's a couple of different ways, and I would say one of the easiest ways is if they visit our website for the New Mexico Wildlife Federation, which is www.nmwildlife.com. You can actually click, it's right there in our news section, submit your comment to DOI today, and you can fill out a simple form, and it comes with a little bit of instructions on what kind of comments are useful to DOI, as they've kind of outlined. And you can just, you know, it takes 5 minutes, you can hit submit on that, and we're actually going to mail, we're going to physically mail the copies of those comments to DOI, we're going to submit them electronically. And we're going to hand deliver them to their office just to make sure that nothing gets lost.
Oh, that sounds really great. Yeah. And I like that you guys are giving people some information about what they could say, because sometimes people don't really know what to say. And
yes.
So to go to your website, it was definitely a good way to do it. That's the New Mexico Wildlife Federation website.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
So, Gabe, I understand that a few years ago, you were one of the people who helped with the designation of the Oregon Mountains Desert Peaks National Monument, which you just spoke about briefly, near Las Cruces. Can you talk about how this monument came into existence and what you did?
Sure. If you can't tell, some of these monument stuff is a little personal to me, because I did, you know, helped to create this national monument through advocacy efforts by telling the story in Washington, D.C. to the respective administration and the departments and agencies about why it was important to protect this land that we have in southern New Mexico. I graduated from New Mexico State University, and like a lot of other college students, probably thought that I was going to end up working somewhere outside of the state, definitely somewhere outside of Las Cruces, because I figured the job opportunities were very limited, or I couldn't have the quality of life that I wanted to. You know, I'm going to school and investing in my education for a reason. And we get that throughout the state, right? We call it brain drain. I think we say we export our greatest asset. And one of the things that really tied me to my community that made me realize, hey, Las Cruces is a place where I can stay, I can raise a family, where I can, you know, hopefully get a good job, or if not, create a business, was these beautiful Oregon mountains in my backyard that I woke up and saw every day. Mm-hmm. It was when I started learning about the history and the culture of all these beautiful things that existed right in my backyard that I wouldn't know otherwise. And if they're not protected through some sort of special designation like a monument, then I think we lose that. And so when I went to tell my story as a private citizen about 5 or 6 years ago, that's kind of my story. That was my take on it. It was good for our community. And certainly it's been really good for our community in terms of tourism and economic development that comes from folks coming in to visit the monument. So later on, I got to play a more significant role as a staff member for Senator Martin Heinrich, and looking at the actual policy of the monument and making sure that we didn't exclude traditional uses such as grazing or such as hunting and fishing, things that were important to people and how people were using the land already. So I know that we did our homework. I know that the community had their input. I know that the, you know, policy folks worked really hard to make sure that all the existing uses were there. And that's explicitly written in the proclamation. If you were to read the Oregon Mountains Proclamation mm-hmm. today, all the existing uses are listed there. And so there's absolutely no reason to roll back the monument.
Right. Can you tell us why that monument is important to the economy of Las Cruces and Doñana County? How is it impacting the economy there?
Sure. Well, it's had a tremendous impact. And I think just by putting a star on the map for a community, whether it's on, you know, a digital map where it's an actual map, I'm not sure if people still use the Rand McNally maps, but if those are still being printed, I'm sure there's a big star there now,
right,
with our monument on it. But there's people that travel throughout the country searching for national parks or national monuments to visit. There's international, for example, students that come in to a community like El Paso that are looking for opportunities to explore their surroundings while they're here. There's business people that come and want to know, what can I do here? And inevitably, they look at our monument as an attraction and an opportunity to come to our community and spend their dollars, you know, with lodging, with restaurants, fueling up their cars, hopefully buying some trinkets in Mesilla and other places. And so we've seen that collective impact of tourism and the jobs that it's been able to create and the businesses that have been spurred from taking people out to the monument. And it's really, that's the most direct benefit, I think, that we've seen. And hopefully the benefit we continue to see that's not as tangential as the tourism is that it creates a sense of place for us. Mm-hmm. And I think by creating a sense of place for our community, it inspires people to stay in Las Cruces and to create jobs and to start their families and to be leaders in our community. And so I think that is a story that's going to take much longer to play out economically. But, you know, if my testimony today is any sign that that's going to continue happening, then I think there's a positive future for Las Cruces in the monument, too.
Yeah, I agree. There's a lot of studies that show that there's a big economic impact to having public lands near a community or a city or a town, because people want that quality of life that they just don't have if there's nowhere to get outside.
Absolutely.
You know, your backyard's only so big, and then you need to get out into some public lands. I wanted to ask you, Gabe, we need to take a break in just a minute, but I wanted to ask you about the job that you had before you started working for the New Mexico Wildlife Federation. So you used to be a field representative to Senator Martin Heinrich. What did you do in this position?
Sure. So the way that and every congressional office, I think, works a little bit differently in how they organize their field staff, so their state staff. But for me, I had a portfolio of issues that I worked on and a territory. So I worked the southwest part of the state, and my issues were border security, immigration, a little bit of public lands. I worked on economic development, international trade, and what they called poverty issues and civil rights issues.
Wow.
And so, yeah, that runs
a lot.
It runs the gamut. But it was actually a really cool opportunity to know how all of those issues blend together in our communities and mm-hmm. how one issue affects the other and how disenfranchised communities or communities in need all benefit from being united in so many of these efforts to really improve our quality of life here. So that job was... it was unique in that I got to spend a lot of time on the border, because for New Mexicans living in this part of the state, a lot of, for example, our economic development opportunities and international trade that are the most promising are on the border. Some of our, obviously, border security issues that have been such a hot topic nationally are here. You know, we're front and center here. And then when it comes to poverty, I think the three poorest counties in New Mexico are in the southwest part of the state. So... And then civil rights, you know, you're talking about what the effect is of Border Patrol being able to basically operate with a constitutional waiver, you know, up to 120 miles outside of our border through these checkpoints. And there's a lot of civil rights issues associated with that. So my job was to basically find out how our office could help people whenever they were having those particular issues, to see how legislation and policy was having an impact on people in our community as it relates to those issues, mm-hmm. and also to help create solutions and craft new policy to address some of the needs that we could help with in our community. So some of those, the more tangible ones was, you know, I helped try to expand the commercial hours at the port of entry in Santa Teresa so that we could have more economic benefit from our international trade. We helped secure another gate for the Columbus port of entry for safety reasons for the kids coming over for school. So okay. Lots of cool stuff like that.
Well, yeah, really good. Well, I want to talk with you some more about that, about public lands and the importance of citizen engagement when we come back from this break. Welcome back to Earth Matters here on KURU 89.1 FM. This is Donna Stevens, your host for today's program. And today we're talking about public lands, public participation. And I have two guests here, Gabe Vasquez of the New Mexico Wildlife Federation. Gabe needs to leave in about 10 minutes or so. And Jason Amaro of the Backcountry Hunters and Anglers is going to be joining us for the second part of the show. So, Gabe, right before the break, you were talking about how before you started working with the New Mexico Wildlife Federation, you worked for Senator Martin Heinrich. And were you in Washington, D.C., or? were you based here?
I was based here, actually. I worked for a public policy nonprofit called First Focus, and that was a job that actually helped me to create some policy for New Mexico as it relates to child welfare. So I did work in D.C. and here, but my time spent working for the senator was here in the state.
Okay. And I was thinking that these days it's really easy for citizens to be cynical and to distrust government. And I wonder if you could tell us what you observed when you worked for Senator Heinrich about the influence that citizens actually have over our elected officials, and how important is it for us to be involved?
That's a great question, and I think we've seen now more than ever how important public participation and public dialogue is as it pertains to local, regional, state, and federal politics. And certainly we are the ones who elect and who hire people and pay folks to represent us in our respective communities and in Washington, D.C. And I agree with you. And, you know, you can get very cynical, especially considering what's happening up on the Hill. You know, is a lot of people are asking themselves, does our voice matter? Are we having any impact in what's happening nationally? But I can tell you here that locally that we are blessed to have representation from two great senators in our state and some wonderful state representatives up north as well. And so part of my job, like you said, was to take that public participation and dialogue and turn it into meaningful asks of our office, whether it came to policy or whether it was something as simple as, hey, you know, Senator Heinrich, you need to come and listen to these people who have a very serious issue with transportation, let's say for veterans to get their, you know, medical needs met. And they're not being able to do that right now because the existing pot of funds is not there. If folks don't speak up about something like that, then maybe that would have never happened. Mm-hmm. And so we bring people together, you know, the senator and other staff take a leadership role in that and hopefully help make a difference. So we were just talking, I know, Donna, before the show about you calling into senators' offices. And, you know, I talk with some of my former colleagues and they say, you know, we're inundated with calls. You know, it's hard to get our work done because, you know, everybody's on the phones all the time. And I say, oh, man, that's got to be really challenging. And they say, no, it's actually a breath of fresh air because we're getting calls from people thanking us for doing the right thing. And at least when I worked there, it wasn't, you know, most of the calls were either somebody needed help or somebody wanted to complain about something, which is fine. But, you know, when you're doing a good job, you don't hear that a lot of the times from your constituents. And it reinforces the actions of your elected officials to say, hey, I'm on the right track here. Yeah. So even something as simple as, hey, thank you for your support on the Oregon Mountain Desert Peaks National Monument, or thank you for, you know, caring about our recreation economy, it sends a message to our elected officials that, hey, I'm representing my constituents. I'm doing the right thing here. So I encourage people to do that, and just as much as when people have issues, is to be able to voice their positive comments as well.
Right. Yeah. Everybody needs to know that they're doing the right thing so that they're encouraged to keep doing it, right?
Yeah, that's right. Yep.
And I also just wanted to say that certainly I've called my senators and representatives before the current administration came into power, but I call a lot more now because there are so many more things going on that I don't like. And when I call, I mean, I just leave a simple message like, you know, I'm Senator Heinrich's constituent, and I would like to ask him to vote this way on a particular bill. Is that all people need to do, or can you give us any tips about what we should say when we call? So, is there anything good to know?
That's a great question, and I'll tell you kind of my biggest secret, and I guess some of my colleagues might not like that I say this, but
it's not a secret anymore.
It's not a secret, but I would start with, especially if it's an issue that you want addressed or a response that you want that has some really significant details to it. You say, you know, I don't want a form letter. That's what I start my conversation with when I'm talking to particularly a representative I call often here in our district. And I say, look, I don't want a form letter. I know what your position is on this issue or your boss's position is. What I want to know is, you know, what does he think about the potential for 250,000 New Mexicans losing health care? What is the rationale for that? And I want a specific response. And so a lot of the times that really closes that loop where they can't simply, you know, queue up a form letter. You know, they go pull down a menu and it says, you know, caller upset about AHCA. They plug in your address and then you get a form letter in the mail and you have a dissatisfied constituent that says, hey, this doesn't address the question I asked. And so I always start with saying, look, I don't want a form letter because that takes that out of the equation for them. Not to say they won't send you one anyway, but most of the times they have to give you a more substantial response. And then when it comes to urging them to vote for a particular bill or an issue or support something, they do tally up those votes. And so when you call, for example, let's say that there's 500 constituents that say they want tighter, you know, standards for, you know, the FDA or something like that. Mm-hmm. And then there's five that say that they don't. They tally those up. And at the end of the day, the legislative director or somebody in the office goes through those responses and says, okay, this is what kind of feedback we've gotten from our district or from our state. So it does matter. It does matter. And those, even if it's just something to say, hey, I support or I don't support, that gets put on a tally somewhere. Hopefully it helps influence the decision of the politician, but I think each one is unique in how what they decide to do with that information.
Right. So. Okay, that's really good information to have. I like having the inside track. So, Gabe, I know that you need to leave because you need to head back to Las Cruces for a meeting, and I really want to thank you so much for joining us here on Earth Matters, driving all the way here to be on the show for 40 minutes or so. And best of luck in your work. But I also want to say that we still have 20 minutes in the show, so please don't go away. Thank you, Gabe, for being
here.
I'll
be listening on the way home. Thank
you
so much.
All right, very good. Yes, because your colleague, Jason Amaro, is here in the station now, and he's going to be picking up where you left off. Thank you very much, Gabe. And welcome, Jason.
Thanks for having me.
So, Jason, you work for the Backcountry Hunters and Anglers, and I just want to ask you, for listeners who aren't familiar with your group, what if you're a national group or a regional group, and what you do, what your mission is?
Yeah, so absolutely. So last time I was on the show, I worked with Trout Unlimited at a state role. Now I work for Backcountry Hunters and Anglers. We're a national organization. I'm the regional director, so my chapters are Texas, Arizona, New Mexico, Utah, Nevada. So I'm the Southwest coordinator. The good thing is that we are definitely focused on public lands. It's a much narrower focus, but it allows us a lot of flexibility. So public lands, stream access, those are issues that are important to New Mexicans and people across the Southwest.
Well, you know, we talked a little bit about public lands with Gabe Vasquez, and we were talking about the Trump administration's review of national monuments and what's going on there. But that certainly isn't the only public lands issue going on. That is a big one right now. But, I mean, there's also this move that's been going on for a few years to transfer federal lands to the state. I wonder if you can talk about why that is such a poor idea.
You know, especially in the Southwest, like in New Mexico, in our own backyard, we talk about the Silver Fire or the Whitewater Baldy Fire. These are major, major fires. And when people start talking about the transfer of federal land over to state, my first question is always, how are we going to afford it? I mean, literally, how are we going to afford to turn off these fires? The state land office has very few firefighters. I think it's a handful, maybe like 10.
Oh, wow.
So there's just no way that the citizens of New Mexico can pick up that tab. So what's going to have to happen is the state land office is going to have to make money somehow. It's just the bottom line. And unfortunately, that points to the sale of federal lands. So, yeah, it's a big issue. If you're a hunter, an angler, an outdoorsman, you know, biker, hiker, whatever, state trust land is not public land. If you go to their website, and I challenge you to do this, go look at the state, you know, website for the state trust lands. Right on the front page, it says state trust land is not public land. And it is very, very clear. If you're an outdoors person, just to be on state land, you have to be properly permitted. There's a whole bunch of restrictions. For example, if you're a fisherman or a hunter, you cannot be on that land 2 days prior before your hunt. Okay, you can't camp on that hunt or during your hunt on state land. And most importantly, if you happen to have, you know, five people in your party, one of them is going to have to stay home. So you can only take four people on your hunting permit or fishing permit. So if you have more than four kids, you know, someone's going to get the short end of the stick and they have to stay home. You know, and it's just one of those things is why is it so restrictive? I mean, for a long time, there's been organizations out there really pressing to have the ability to camp on state lands. That's kind of been our goal. And there are organizations out there that are pushing for it. So that's kind of the big issues is, you know, bottom line is the state can't afford it. And it's much more restrictive than federal lands.
What are state lands for? I mean, they seem like they're quite a bit different than federal public land.
Yeah, absolutely. Great question. So federal land, it's, you know, and I'll summarize here. So federal land is pretty much for the enjoyment of people. That's kind of its, mm-hmm. that's kind of its land of many uses. So we can go out there, we can hunt, fish, hike, bike, do whatever we want to do. Also, there's grazing on it. There's stuff like that. So I always say that federal land is much more, it's just more family friendly. It doesn't mm-hmm. have the task of making a profit. And that's the difference with state land. State land absolutely has to make a profit to fund stuff like schools and hospitals in the state. So their task is entirely different than federal lands.
I want to talk about that some more with you. Please stay with us and we'll come back and talk more about public lands with Jason Amaro. Welcome back to Earth Matters here on KURU 89.1 FM. I'm Donna Stevens, your host for today's program, and my guest is Jason Amaro of the Backcountry Hunters and Anglers. We're continuing our conversation about public lands here. Right before the break, Jason, you were saying that state lands have a very different purpose than, and charter, maybe I could use that word, than federal lands, that state lands have to make money. And so can you tell us a little bit more about that?
Absolutely. So I'll go back into a little bit of my history. So I actually used to work for what they call the Tax and Rev Office in Santa Fe. And I used to work in the state land office building. And every Monday, or I think it was Monday or Friday, there would be these leases, these lease sales. And I'd go down there, and I was a young kid at the time. Young, I think, is now relative, but I must have been in my late 20s. So I would go down there, and they'd have these oil and gas lease sales. And I'd sit there kind of in the auditorium, and they used to, you know, just bid on these sections of state trust land where they would do some drilling, exploration, that type of thing. So these oil companies would come in, they would bid, okay, you know, $1 million, whatever. And they were monthly sales. And that is where the state trust lands are much different. They have monthly sales where they try to raise money for our schools, for our hospitals, for that type of thing. Originally, these state trust lands were given to the state by the federal government way back in the day as an effort to try to fund these institutions. So the federal lands don't have that charter, as you said. You know, they're not tasked with making money. You know, and as you can imagine, it often becomes very political, just like most state things. So it's always we're just trying to raise money for our school kids or our hospitals. But, you know, the real issue is that really it? For example, in New Mexico, on state trust lands, hunters and anglers had paid $200,000 a year for access. So that allowed, if you had a hunting or fishing license, you could hunt or fish state trust lands within a whole bunch of restrictions during your hunting season. So the state game department paid the state land office $200,000. Well, Aubrey Dunn came in and he started really raising the fees on us.
And Aubrey Dunn is?
The state land commissioner. It's a voted position. It's an elected official. And that's why I always say, you know, elections have consequences, you know, and so not to get too political, but that's kind of how the whole thing went. So he went from $200,000 a year to almost $1 million a year. Hmm. You know, and sportsmen have always been willing to and happy to pay those funds, but things don't go up that high without some sort of retribution. So it was tough on sportsmen, but we did it. The game department go ahead and renegotiated the contract. We went through with it. It was all approved. The good thing is that it's now for 3 years as opposed to having to be negotiated every year. So okay. That was a good thing. And one of the another big things that we're working on with Backcountry Hunters and Anglers is just access in general. Because right now we pay for access for land that is accessible or even landlocked. So it's kind of a big deal. So we're paying for land that we can't even get to.
What kind of land are you talking about here?
So state trust land.
Okay.
So if state trust land is surrounded by private property, we can't get to it, but we're still paying for it.
Uh-huh.
So there has been some discussion, especially for the State Department or the Game and Fish Commission. They've said, well, we shouldn't be paying for land that we can't access.
Right.
Because effectively, these landowners have their own little private hunting leases.
Nice for them.
Nice for them. Pretty good deal. You know, and everybody should be able to get to it. I know I come from the hunter and angler point of view, but the thing about public lands, you know, on Facebook, part of my job is kind of to monitor the Facebook stuff. And there's a meme, as the kids call it these days.
Right.
And it says, right wing, left wing, we're all part of the same bird. And it kind of makes me think, you know, with public lands, it's one of the few things that really unites people.
Uh-huh.
You know, we all use it. We may use it a little differently.
Right.
You know, but we still use it. And I think that's one thing that we really need to focus on. So there is some, you know, there is some discussion about possibly if the public cannot access a piece of property, then we shouldn't pay for it. I think that's the bottom line, because we're paying for it right now, whether we like it or not. UNM, they are actually working on a project right now where they're trying to map inaccessible state trust land. So it'll be really interesting to see, you know, how much of that property really is inaccessible.
Right.
So that's one of our issues. Another big issue, kind of changing gears on you here.
That's fine.
Sorry.
Go ahead.
Thanks. One of our other issues is stream access. So the idea of stream access. So what does that mean? So in New Mexico, according to our Constitution and according to two different attorney generals, we should have stream access. So what does stream access mean? So what it means is you should be able to walk down a stream, any stream, even if it has private property on both sides, if you have gained access to that stream via a public way. Okay. So if I was able to get in there publicly, I should be able to walk up and down that stream and fish or hike or scuba dive or
You need water for that.
You need water. Yeah. I don't know. Maybe snorkel, but just do whatever you want to do. You should be able to be on that piece of property.
And you can't right now, you're saying?
Well, it's very ambiguous right now.
Okay.
So the Constitution says something. We have some rules and laws that say something else. The Game and Fish Department has said something else. So it's kind of up in the air. So it's, you know, ultimately, like a lot of this stuff, it's going to take a lawsuit and to figure out what's going on. And the whole idea behind all of this stream access thing, it's actually pretty simple. So way back in the day, what they said is, this actually goes back to the timber industry, that in theory, if you were able to float a log down a stream, you should have access to it.
Okay.
And that's just kind of a commerce clause, you know, just to keep people being able to sell land, or not sell land, sell lumber.
Uh-huh.
So it's just kind of an interesting little hook. We're working hard on stream access. It's going to take, like I said, it's probably going to take a lawsuit. The Attorney General Balderas, he's actually given us a favorable opinion that we should have access. And so did King prior to that. So, you know, we're looking out there trying to figure out what it is, you know, what's the issue. And of course, in New Mexico, we have a very special set of conditions. I mean, does a stream mean arroyo? I don't know. Does it mean, you know, anything that's just a creek? And so, again, we go back to the whole floating log down the river.
Right.
So it is very touchy. And I think that sportsmen, you know, they're appreciative. They're respectful of private land rights. I absolutely believe that with my heart. So it's going to be interesting to see how this all plays out. And I think that ultimately we don't want it to be a free for all, but we want to have some sort of access.
And why is this an important issue for hunters and anglers?
You know, just to be able to get out and enjoy, you know, Mother Nature, you know, and not only hunters and anglers, but, you know, inner tubers.
Yeah.
You know, it's interesting. Texas, which is one of my states, is they have 2% public lands. 2% public land. I mean, that just blows my mind.
Yeah.
But they have a very liberal stream access rule.
Huh.
So if you've been to San Marcos, San Antonio, they have these huge inner tubing type of things where kids, they all get together and they inner tube the river. And I think I'm a little too old for that drama because there's always beer involved and it's just kind of crazy. But, you know, you'll have 20, you know, I'd say 10,000 people on a weekend floating down a stream in an inner tube. And that's in a state with some of the most restrictive private land access issues out there.
Huh.
Yeah, and it would just be fun. I mean, I'd love to be able to float, you know, from maybe the East Fork all the way down or without any issues. I know that there are some concerns about some landowners down by Verdun about, you know, putting barbed wires across the river, the Gila River. And someone's going to get hurt.
Yes.
Someone's going to get hurt, you know. And as long as you stay below with stream access, the idea is you can float down the stream, but you have to stay below the high water marks. I mean, that's totally reasonable. I totally agree. I mean, sure, you can float it, you know, get down there, do whatever you have to do. If you have to go to the restroom, pull over, go to the restroom, as long as it's below the high water marks. And I think that that's reasonable. You know, that's absolutely reasonable.
So that means you're not intruding very far onto people's private property?
Exactly. So sometimes it's 2-3 feet.
Yeah.
You know, it just depends on the high water mark.
Right.
And in New Mexico, if you've ever been down to like Turkey Creek or the Box Canyon, I mean, it always amazes me and others when I take them out there, if you look up in the trees, you'll see where that high water mark was. I mean, it's how high? It's 10, 15 feet probably?
Yes, it can be pretty scary.
I mean, so you're like, holy cow, at one time, there was water coming down that high.
Right.
And I don't think people realize it because, like, you know, recently we got back from a float trip in Montana. And their high water mark was, you know, 2 or 3 feet.
Really?
Yeah. And I'm like, guys, that's nothing.
Yeah. It could be 20 feet above your head in the Gila middle box.
Exactly. Exactly. And that's got, you know, so, you know, when we get those monsoon seasons or summer rains, I mean, that water can really, really change. But that's what makes, you know, New Mexico, Southwest, all of us, it's just different.
Right. Well, we only have a couple minutes left in the show, Jason, so I wanted to make sure to ask you what other kinds of issues backcountry hunters and anglers works on that are, as I was saying to Gabe earlier in the show, he works for the New Mexico Wildlife Federation, and I'm not a hunter or an angler, but I find that I have a lot in common with these organizations because you also work on conservation issues.
Absolutely. And I think that's the big thing. And it makes my heart happy in a sense that hunters and anglers are kind of, they're really embracing the idea of conservation.
Mm-hmm.
They're getting out there and doing things. For example, last weekend we had a group up at Willow Creek. They were taking some water samples and they were just working on the reintroduction of wild and native Gila trout. I mean, so we've been involved in that. In August, there's going to be another fish survey up at Willow Creek.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a lot of fun. I mean, I think in a lot of ways, anglers and hunters have really taken ownership of Gila trout. And like, we're going to make this happen. We're going to get them reintroduced into their wild and native grounds one way or the other. And it's just interesting. If you look at the fishing itself for Gila trout, there are two different populations. One are recovery and one are recreation. And recovery are off limits. I mean, we don't fish for those. It's all said and done. But we're still working and we're still helping with those populations of fish.
So those are just in certain streams or rivers?
Yeah. Oh, okay. Certain streams that shall remain nameless.
Okay. can't fish for Gila trout.
Exactly.
Right. Okay.
Exactly. No, but if you did some research, you could go ahead and find it. But I think the idea is that, you know, we're helping funding those projects and we're getting out there and we're planting willows, which is a lot of fun. Fun, probably quotations for most people. But I mean, you're just, the idea is to cool down the water temperatures for those fish, you know, and that really helps everybody. Yeah. So I think, you know, we're turning the corner here and we're seen as conservationists. We're seen as people that are willing to reach across the aisle. And I say that, you know, in a strange way, I guess. We're willing to work with other partners to really help get better access, more access, more consistent access to public lands.
Right. So, Jason, in the minute that we have left, I wanted to ask you, what can listeners do if they want to have their voices heard on public lands issues? We talked with Gabe Vasquez earlier in the show about the importance of contacting your senators or your representatives, but what else can people do?
Yeah, so I always say my job is to inform, educate, and engage, get people engaged.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's not about me. It's about getting people engaged. Gabe said something interesting about no form letters. Absolutely. No form letters.
Yeah.
It you know, at the State Game Commission and some of the land office, it's when they talk about these comments, they'll say something. We had five letters and 35 robo forms.
Uh-huh.
So they actually make the difference, a robo form. You know, so yeah, just so get engaged, get involved in your local groups. Everybody has a voice. Educate yourselves. I think that that we're on the right side of history here as far as public lands, and we need to remember that. And sure, there's going to be some wins and there's going to be some losses, mm-hmm. but we just really need to get out there and enjoy it. And most importantly, I think that if you're really going to show value to our public lands, just get out there, go hiking, fishing, camping, enjoy the weather. I know it's a little blustery out there today, but get out there and enjoy it, you know, and have a connection to the land and share it with your kids.
Great. Thank you so much. Well, I want to thank you, Jason, for joining me on today's show. And thanks for Gabe Vasquez, who was here earlier. Please join us next week for Earth Matters.